Yeah, go for it.
Is that right?
No, I just have to use my... to project my voice. Having given many talks over many years, many times, the microphone does not work. So you can project your voice is actually much more fun. Because I'm sure when the Buddha was alive, he never had to use microphones. And still, he could talk to thousands of people. But first of all, for the subject for this evening's talk, any suggestions?
Jhanas.
Well, you're on for meditation.
Meditation. Oh, really? Okay. It's very nice to know that. Could I have my glass of water?
Yeah.
And we'll start with a few similes of meditation and the jhanas. Very good. So be careful. Here we go. Simile number one. I gave this simile recently, about a year ago, I was invited to a conference to give a keynote address at the World Computer Conference in Brisbane. I know nothing about computers, so I was interested to go to a conference and speak on nothing I knew. Something new. But at that conference, I gave the following simile, and this was actually printed in the Australian newspaper, and it's now on the website of the Australian Stock Exchange. It's true. On how to deal with stress. And the simile is, this is actually quite serious, and it's actually very important for you. How heavy is this cup of water? Please don't tell me how many ounces it is, because the answer is, the longer you hold it, the heavier it feels. If I keep holding this for maybe another minute, my arm will begin to ache. After 5 minutes, I'll be in pain. After 15 minutes, if I keep holding it like this, I'll be in agony and a very stupid monk. What should I do when it starts getting too heavy to bear? You put it down. You don't need to throw it away. You put it down for maybe 1 minute. You rest, and when you pick it up again afterwards, it's actually exactly the same amount of water in the glass, but it actually feels lighter. If you don't believe me, you can try this at home. Now the point of this simile is, all stress in life has nothing to do with how much water is in your glass, how much work is on your desk, how many responsibilities and duties you have in your life. That is not the cause of stress. The cause of stress is holding your glass for too long, and when it gets heavy, not knowing how to put it down and rest. How to put it down and to rest is a job of meditation. For you must also know it's important to rest. Because 5 minutes of meditation, even 5 minutes, is not wasting time. It means after you've rested your arm, after you've rested your mind in meditation, you will find you'll be able to carry your responsibilities and burdens with far greater ease and much greater efficiency. Remember, at work, it's not how long you spend in front of that computer screen, is how efficient you spend that time. When people are tired because of stress, it means they're not using their brain efficiently. Rest for a few minutes, and the 5, 10, 15 minutes you spend in meditation are made up afterwards by greater efficiency, where you do 3 hours work in 2 and of high quality. That is why we meditate. Now, how to meditate, it's very important. The reason I was a bit late, I was giving a talk to some people in the north of London. In Buddhism, too many people call meditation concentration. That is a very inaccurate translation of the term samadhi. If you ask any Pali scholar, they will say that that translation was made a long time ago, it's way past its use by date, and it also gives the wrong impression of what meditation is. Concentration was something I was told to do at school. Concentrate! It was forceful, it was fearful, and it made me more tense. Moreover, that there are some places you can go for a meditation retreat, where if they call it concentration, it becomes very much like a concentration camp. Which is very un-Buddhist, and it doesn't give you good results. So for many years now, I've been pushing aside that old translation and using another rendering which is far more accurate to the Pali and the Sanskrit. It's called stillness. So please look at the goal of meditation as stillness. And recently, one of my disciples, she was from mainland China, living in the United States, came with her friend who was a professor of finance at MIT in Massachusetts, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. And when I was mentioning that samadhi, what the goal of meditation is about, is called stillness, she was very excited because she had been studying the Chinese Agamas, which is the Chinese version of the Buddha's teachings. And there, that word samadhi has been rendered for maybe 1500 to 1800 years, not as concentration, but the two Chinese words, and anyone who knows Chinese will probably laugh at my pronunciation, it's shur and gun, still and mindful, is the words for samadhi in the Pali, in the Chinese Agamas. Never ever means concentration. So those early scholars who translated from the Sanskrit into the Chinese had a very good idea of what meditation was. Stillness and mindfulness. Now once you have the idea in your heads that meditation is all about stillness, you understand what the destination is, the path to that destination becomes much clearer. Because how can you make stillness with effort? All trying disturbs the mind. I will now give the second simile. Desmond, I will need your assistance here. So you can stay where you are, but because you're sitting in the front and you're a reputable man whose words are regarded as truthful, I want you to tell me when this glass of water becomes still, because now my aim is to hold this water perfectly still. Has it stopped moving yet? Okay, so let's try harder. How about now? Okay, I've got to really focus, come on. Is it still yet?
No.
This is how many people meditate. They try hour after hour, day after day, year after year, try to make the mind still, and they only get frustrated. Fortunately, there is a very easy way to get this glass of water to be perfectly still, which is, put it down. Now, you may notice in the front, as soon as I put it down, it actually moves more than usual. In meditation, when you really start to let things go and leave it alone, at first it moves more than it was before. But after a few seconds, Desmond, how is that water now?
Still.
There we are. Please, a big round of applause from my assistant, Desmond. Just like in a magic show. Now, here is a great simile of meditation. You try and make your mind still, and it becomes impossible to do. You get frustrated, and after a while, many people give up. The trick in meditation to get still is to put things down, to leave them alone, and watch as they become still, all by themselves. before the Buddha became enlightened, he put his bowl in the Nirmala River with the resolution, if I am to become enlightened, let the bowl flow upstream against the current. And of course, it did. That was not just an omen for the future enlightenment of our Buddha, it was also an indication of the way that enlightenment would happen. This was mentioned again and again in the teachings of the Buddha. You have to go against the stream of craving, not with the stream of craving, to stop the craving and learn how to be still. And with stopping all wanting, then the mind becomes perfectly still. A strange thing happens with stillness. The following simile shows how stillness, joy, and mindfulness all work together. Where I live in Australia is about 60 kilometers south of the city of Perth, in the hills. When we were looking for a place to build a Buddhist monastery, we thought that it is traditional that holy men have to live on top of a mountain. And we like to keep those traditions. You never hear of holy people living in swamps, with the exception of Yoda in Star Wars. But that is not Buddhism, that's just Hollywood. So we tried to find the nearest mountain. It wasn't a tall mountain, it was only a hill, but it would do. And when we started building that monastery, in which I've been living for the last 28 years, whenever I would go up that hill to where our monastery gate was sited, it was about 2 and a bit kilometers. And I think it was about 7 years I'd been living in that monastery when the first time I decided to walk up that hillside. I'd arrived early, it was a beautiful spring morning, I had plenty of time, and of course, you know, I need the exercise. In Australia, Buddhism is expanding, so am I. So, for the first time in 7 years, I decided to walk up that hillside. And as I was walking up that hillside, just taking my time, as I looked around, a strange experience happened. I could not recognize my surroundings. The hillside looked totally different than anything I'd seen before, and that was shocking for me. For 7 years I'd been going up and down that hillside in a car, looking through the window, and now I saw things I was seeing for the very first time. Why hadn't I noticed them before? And it was such a strange experience, I stopped and stared. When I stopped still, I saw even more things which I had never ever noticed. Blades of grass, little rocks, lichen on the rocks, the tessellated bark of the trees, little flowers poking out between the rocks and the grass. And the whole looked so beautiful, more beautiful than I'd ever remembered seeing through the window of the car. And the whole thing was so surprising. And I started contemplating what on earth is happening. Because I was trained as a scientist, and Buddhism is a very scientific, rational religion, some people ask whether it is a religion or not. In Australia, the standard answer is yes, Buddhism is a religion, for tax purposes anyway. Anyway, it was such a strange experience, I started using my science, and I realized when you look through the window of a car traveling at speed, your eye does not have the time to form a proper image on the back of your retina before another image comes up, dislodges the first, and then another one, and then another one. The images follow one after the other so quickly that not one image fully forms, and the colours made by the chemical reaction on your retina do not fully form either. When you look through the window of a speeding car, you just see flashes, not fully formed, whose colour is pastel and washed out. It just doesn't have the time to fully form. But when you walk, because you're going slower, the image has more time to form and the colours are richer. You literally see more and the texture is deeper. But only when you stand still and look without moving, only then does the image have the time required to fully form with all its detail, and the colours are so deep and rich. Greens like you've never seen green before, with all its different shades. All the greys of the rock fully become alive. You can see them all, because only now do they fully take their place in the image in the back of your eye, and your mind has the time to explore it all. And it looks so incredibly beautiful. And from that experience, the great simile of why stillness is important, to see what's really out there and to appreciate its beauty. We live life as if in a speeding car looking through the window. We think we know the surroundings, but all you're really seeing is just a fraction of what's really out there. And more importantly, the colours, the depth of experience is washed out because you don't have time before another experience comes up. When you go slow, you see much more and becomes more and more beautiful. The mindfulness becomes stronger with stillness. And also, surprising to me, but when I read through the teachings of the Buddha, it was obvious, it should have known this, with stillness comes powerful mindfulness and joy. And that becomes the path of the meditation. The more you stand still and just watch, the clearer your watching becomes, and the more joyful what you see becomes. The whole world becomes more beautiful. Surprising, but true. So often it has been, when I've been teaching meditation retreats, people have complimented the cook. What a beautiful, or what a skillful cook we have at our meditation retreats. The dishes are so delicious. But after the retreat, the same cook's meals are not so tasty. The first time this happened, when I was still at Cambridge, the students there held a meditation retreat at three boarding houses in Bateman Street in Cambridge during the vacation. I signed up with trepidation. The reason was that I was scared of the cooking. This was in 1970, and at that time the English were well known, and I was one of them, as being terrible cooks. We used to have in those days a three-course meal, meat and two veggies. And the veggies, it didn't matter what they were, they tasted the same, because whatever taste there was had been boiled out a long time ago. And of all the cooks in this whole land, the very worst, the bottom of the pile, were those who got jobs to cook for poor students who didn't have the money to have any alternative. So when I heard we were going to go to a boarding house and have boarding house food for 9 days, I really seriously contemplated buying sandwiches. But to my great surprise, on that retreat, my first meditation retreat, the food was delicious. And I thought it was just my good karma to have happened upon one cook who could actually do something with the vegetables instead of just boiling the hell out of them. But now I realize there was nothing to do with the cook. and everything to do with my mindfulness. My mindfulness would become so sharp that whatever tiny remnant of flavour had been left after all that, I could pick up. Now, if that would make boarding house food in the 70s taste delicious, imagine what it would be like to go to a proper restaurant round the corner. The moral of this story is, if you are going out to an expensive restaurant, meditate first and get your money back. But this is one of the byproducts. And you see that byproduct because, like I'm saying this, any monk or nun or meditator who's got success in their meditation will be a happy person. It's part of the result of meditating. If you don't believe me, I refer you to the Dhammacharya Sutra in the Majjhima Nikaya. Because sometimes people say, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you just make this up yourself. And I don't just make it up myself. Well, some of it I do. But I also quote the sutras. In that sutra, the king Pasenadi, who was one of the supporters of the Buddha, the king of the Kosalans, he went to visit the Buddha in the famous Jetavana monastery, usually called the Jetagrodha. And he went to visit the Buddha for the last time. And he asked to go in to the Buddha's hut, because he was inside. The other monk said, because you're the king, I imagine they would let you in. It's the same whether the Queen of England wanted to visit one of the nuns or monks at Amawati. Usually say, no, no one is allowed. But if it was Her Majesty the Queen, I think she would be allowed in. In the same way, the king was given special permission to enter the Buddha's hut. And the king just bowed at the Buddha's feet with great gratitude and joy and said that it's been such wonderful times as having you as my teacher who lives so close by. I'm so fortunate. He had really devotion to his teacher. But then the Buddha asked him, said, why do you love coming here? And the answer the king gave, recorded in the sutras for posterity, is really important. He said, I come here and I enjoy coming to this monastery because whenever I come here, the monks are always smiling and happy. That's why I love coming there. And the Buddha replied, yes, great king, that's what you can expect if the monks are having success in their meditation and developing insight. You'd expect them to be happier. As you lessen the suffering of the world, as you relinquish your attachments, you expect yourself to be more light-hearted, more happy, less heavy-hearted, more smiling. Even in the time of the Buddha, so today. So if you develop your meditation, your happiness level will go up. It's part of the meditation. So we need to somehow slow down and stop. It's a very difficult thing for people to do, especially in a city like London, because we are such great achievers. We have done so much and achieved so much through our effort. We have to try another way. Fortunately, the Buddha left many, many great teachings on how to let go. And the one which I'm going to focus on this evening, the one of many, is in one of the greatest well-known teachings of the Buddha, the very first sermon called the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, where the Buddha first taught the Four Noble Truths. And in the Third Noble Truth, he taught the four ways of letting go. How to meditate in one of the core teachings, the first teaching given by the Buddha. The four ways of letting go. The first is called chaga, or generosity. You know, in our monastery in Australia, we don't have donation boxes. We have letting go boxes. So here in the Buddhist Society in London, I'm sure that after this talk you can find the letting go box and do the first part of your generosity. But be careful, because some people they do letting go, they do generosity and donations, expecting something back in return. They expect maybe sort of, I don't know if you get a tax receipt so you can get sort of reduction of your tax, or sometimes people give a donation so they can have their name emblazoned on the wall, that this is Ajahn Brahm Hall, or this is Tony Blair, David Cameron, I've got to remember the new title. This is David Cameron Meditation Center. Think that might happen?
No.
Okay, well, you have to live in hope, positive thinking. But anyhow, that would not be generosity. That would be what we call buying advertising rights for your name. It's doing business, isn't it? So if you give generosity, you have to give expecting nothing back in return. Otherwise, it's not really giving. And that idea of doing something, expecting nothing back, is the heart of the first type of letting go. Indeed, my teacher, the famous Ajahn Chah, used to say again and again and again that you meditate not to get attainments, you meditate to let go of things, to give, expecting nothing back in return. To be able to do that is the first type of letting go. So if you're meditating and you want to get something, it's not meditating. You're meditating not to try and get things, but to see how many things can disappear. How much you can let go of, not how much you can gain. The well-known Vajrayana teacher who passed away, who was an alcoholic, Chogyam Trungpa, did he ever come here and give a talk?
Oh, yes.
He did, a long time ago, yeah. Mm. That's right, because he was up in Scotland in Samhilinga first. But he once wrote this wonderful article on spiritual materialism. It was a classic. That in our Western world, we have the materialism of trying to get on in the world and trying to make enough money to retire, a house to live in, a car and everything else. That's called materialism. But he also noticed that it has its counterpart in spiritual materialism. In trying to also get your spiritual attainments. So you say, how's your meditation? So you got first jhana. I'm first jhana, I got that years ago. I'm on second jhana now. Second jhana, that's really hopeless. I've got third jhana. That spiritual pride is insidious. It reminds me of a story of these four ladies just round the corner having a cup of coffee. They were all Catholics, and one was very proud because their son had just ordained as a priest. And was so proud, he said, my son is now a Catholic priest. And when women come into his church, they bow their head and they call him, your reverence. And I'm so proud of him. And the second woman said, that's nothing. My son became a priest years ago. He's now a bishop. When women come in the room, they kneel on one knee and they call him, your grace. I'm so proud of him. And the third woman said, they're just a bishop. My son is a cardinal. When he comes in a room, the people actually kneel on both knees to kiss his ring and they call him your eminence. I'm so proud of him. And the fourth woman, sipping her cup of coffee, waits for a while. And then she says her son never joined the clergy. But he plays for Manchester United. He's 6'8", blonde and gorgeous. When women come into the room, they fall on the floor and say, my God, my God! Which is another type of materialism and pride. Here, it's important when you're giving a lecture to tell a funny story from time to time, because that wakes people up and stops them falling asleep. But that first type of letting go is giving, expecting nothing back in return. So when you meditate, if you want to have success, you give. your energy, your time to this moment. Don't expect anything. In fact, you inspect rather than expect. Inspect is looking in. Expecting is looking for something to happen. Real meditation is when you inspect, not expect. It's giving. Giving your energy, your time to this moment without any expectation. The second method of meditation is called freedom. And to understand what freedom is, I like to tell the story of one of my monks who was teaching in a prison. He'd been teaching in this new prison in Western Australia for about 5 or 6 weeks, and the prisoners asked him to stay behind because they wanted just to talk with him. They'd got some chocolate and some tea. They wanted just to get to know their friend and ask questions they hadn't asked when they were doing meditation. So they asked him, first of all, what's it like at your monastery? What do monks actually do throughout the day? And so the monk replied, well, he gave the description of an average day, like in a Buddhist monastery of Ajahn Chah's tradition, this one in Australia. He said, well, we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. And at that, these were prisoners in jail for doing terrible things. They said, even in prison we don't have to get up that time. And the monk did make the observation that in the monastery in Australia where I come from, it's optional. You don't have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. You can always get up earlier if you want to. That's the option. And then he said, what do you do next? Can you watch the late night movie? He said, no, we don't have televisions, you know, in monastery, in our Buddhist monasteries. We meditate. And they said, oh yes, that makes sense, because that's what monks do. That's their job, to meditate. And in fact, it reminds me of another story. And this story is of the person who rang up the monk at the temple and said, I really need your help. Can you please come to my home to do some chanting, do a ceremony? And he said, I'm sorry, madam, I'm very busy. He said, what are you doing? And the monk replied, I'm doing nothing. And that's what a monk is supposed to do, you know, to meditate, relax. And the caller sort of understood and put down the telephone. But the caller rang the following day and rang the same monk and said, I really need you to come and do a ceremony at my home. Can you please come? And the monk replied again, I'm sorry, I'm busy. And the caller said, what are you doing? For the second time, the monk said, nothing. And the caller said, that's what you're doing yesterday. And the monk replied, yes, sir, I'm not finished yet. Because that's what monks are supposed to do, and nuns, and meditators, and Buddhas, you know, just relax, do nothing. And please get that out of the way first, before you do something else. So that's what we're doing, just meditating. And he said, at what time do you have breakfast? In my monastery over in Australia, we do have a little breakfast. We have little mugs, and you can have some cereal, and that's all, just some cereal in a mug, nothing more. And the prisoners in Australia were surprised. I think it's the same here in England. The prisoners have, you know, bacon, they can have eggs, they can have pancakes, they can have toast, fruit, cereals, they can have anything. That's all they give you in a monastery. That's terrible. I said, anyway, what do you do after breakfast? In monastery, you may have been to Amawati or Chittas, the monks have to work quite hard. Many, many times I've been working, laboring, even I'm over 60 now and a senior monk, even I have to get up on the roof and put roofs on and mix concrete with the other monks. In fact, once recently I'd just been mixing concrete with the other monks. We're building another hut, and I enjoy mixing concrete. That's boys' fun. You get all dirty and concrete all over you, splattered with the grey cement, getting really dirty. And after finishing, I was walking back to my hut to have a shower. On the way, I met a Sri Lankan woman who had come to visit. She was a high-class Sri Lankan because she was dressed in an expensive sari, and she had so many bangles on her, she sounded like an ice cream van. There's a few Sri Lankan people here who will know what I mean. She stopped me and said, I've come to see Ajahn Brahm. Where's Ajahn Brahm? Now, I'm a smart man, thinking quickly. I said, well, if you go to the dining hall, he'd probably be there in 10 minutes. I had a shower and quickly changed into a clean robe and went to the dining hall where I sat down and talked to her, and she was very impressed. And before she left, she said, you've got a wonderful monastery and I really like those teachings. It's very good, but if you don't mind me saying something, that on the way here, I met one of your monks, and he was very badly dressed, and it's not appropriate for a Buddhist monk to dress so poorly. So, if you don't mind, would you say something to him? And I said, yes, madam, I will talk to that monk later. She really didn't know it was the same monk. And I wasn't lying, I was keeping my precepts, because I often talk to myself. These stories actually happen, you can't make them up. And so actually I do work very hard. And when some of these prisoners, I think even in English jails, they don't have to work very hard. But when we said how hard we worked, they were surprised. Then they said, what do you do for lunch? And those of you who've seen our tradition, we eat out of a bowl. And everything goes in the one bowl. Many times. I have had chocolate ice cream on green curry. Why do you say, have you ever had ice cream on curry? You don't know what you're talking about. Actually, you're right, it is disgusting. I've had custard on spaghetti. Yeah, that's also disgusting too. Don't recommend it. But they said, even in solitary confinement, they give you a tray with different compartments. It's disgusting how you eat. But what do you do after lunch? You know, can you play some sport? And I often thought of actually starting a Buddhist soccer team. Now, like the London Buddhist Society have their own soccer team, because it would be wonderful for churches to have soccer teams and other religions have soccer teams. So why doesn't the Buddhist Society here start a soccer team? I'll tell you why, because I thought this out in detail. If it was a Buddhist soccer team, it would have to run on Buddhist principles. Number one, compassion. If the other team wanted the ball, you'd have to give it to them. You know, letting go. If they couldn't score a goal, you scored it for them, you know, an own goal. And if you tackled, you know, non-violence, it had to be the softest of tackles. In fact, you wouldn't even touch them. So that would be a Buddhist soccer team. And you realise why we don't have a Buddhist soccer team. Well, if you follow one of the soccer teams here in London, if they always are losing, you know they've got too many Buddhists on the side. So, no, we don't play any sport. We do more meditation after lunch. I said, oh my goodness, that must be tough. I said, what about your dinner? Dinner? Monks of our tradition don't have dinner, we just that's our one meal of the day. And a tiny breakfast if we're working. That's all we have. So my goodness, everybody gets actually many patients, three meals a day, four or five. You get a bit of a something in the afternoon and a supper at night. That's amazing, that's all they feed you. But what do you do after? You know, you have a cup of tea, that's all. What do you after have a cup of tea? You can play cards, play some guitar. No, no, it's more meditation. Oh my goodness, said, this actually happened. The prisoner said, don't you get tired of meditation? The monk said, actually, yes, sometimes. Now, what time do you go to bed? Bed, he said. We don't have beds, we sleep on the floor. Yeah, I sleep on the floor. So that's, everyone gets a little cot and a mattress in prison. That's terrible. And having described the conditions of a Buddhist monastery in the West, they were so disgusted, they were surprised too, how austere a Buddhist monastery is compared to prison. That one of the prisoners, forgetting where they were, said, that's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead? He was invited to stay in jail. And it made me think when I heard the story, why is it that in my monastery there is a big waiting list of people trying to join. And in prison, there's a big waiting list of people trying to get out. What's the difference? Has nothing to do with the comfort or lack of comfort. And I realize the definition of a prison is any place you don't want to be. Freedom, like we experience in a Buddhist monastery, freedom is any place you want to be. And from that I realize that how many prisons we make in our life. You may be in a relationship, in a marriage you don't like. It feels like a prison for you. You may be in a job you hate. It feels like going to jail every morning. You may be in a sick and old body. It's painful. You don't want to be there. It's a prison for you. You may be even in a talk and you want to get out. Then this room is a prison. So how do you escape from the many prisons of life? I tell you, you don't have to change your partner. I've done lots of marriage counselling. If you're thinking of doing that, getting rid of your husband, please understand this great wisdom I've got over many years. They're all the same. So you might as well stick with the one you've got. The same with women. You think you get a better model, they're not. On the outside, they may be different, but the engine's the same inside. So you might as well stick with the one you've got. They don't have to change your partner. You don't have to change your body or get out of this room. To be free, just be happy where you are. This is good enough. To be content, to want to be here, is a meaning of freedom. And that is the second way of letting go. How many times in your day do you really want to be here? And how many times in your day are you busy trying to get somewhere else? You find that sometimes we live our whole day wanting to get somewhere else, wanting to be somewhere else, never really wanting to be where we are. That's why we feel the stress. That's why we never feel free. You know, it doesn't matter where you are. As long as you want to be here, you feel totally free. And when you do any meditation, just wanting to be here with your stupid old mind, with your aching old body, with a mind which is all over the place, if you want to be here, you'll feel free. And that's called letting go. Letting things be. Rather than wanting to be somewhere else. Now of course I've already mentioned when you want to be here, you're not trying to get somewhere else, that's when you become still. You find a strange thing happens in your mind. You want to be here. And at first it's not that comfortable. Just like when you first join a monastery, it's very austere. But after a while it becomes so wonderful, so joyful. Wanting to be here because you're still, the mind starts to get strong and powerful. You see deeply into things, you get lots of joy. And all the thing which you thought your partner, your job, your body wasn't good enough, it is actually beautiful and wonderful. Wanting to be here is one of the secrets of deep meditation. Number one, it keeps you in this beautiful present moment. You don't want to be in the past, that's gone. As far as the future, are you concerned about your future? Are you concerned to have a happy, healthy, wonderful future? Well, where is your future being made? When is the only time you can do anything about your future? Right now. If you're worried about your future, you should put all your attention in the place your future is being made. Now. If you make peace, have a positive attitude, are kind to this present moment, you're making the karma, the only place you can make the karma, for positive health, happiness and well-being in the future. If you understand that, you know what we mean by being here, is a path to deep peace, happiness and insight. It's the second way of letting go, wanting to be here. So if you try meditation, no matter what technique you want to do, want to be here, wherever that happens to be, and that becomes one of the key factors of success in meditation. If you want to be somewhere else, you made a prison, you don't feel free at all, you're not letting go, you're trying to get somewhere else. The other way of letting go is called patiniska, it's called like throwing things away. Now, one of the reasons I've come to England this visit is to see my mother, who's got Alzheimer's disease, and even though she doesn't know me, I know who she is. That's why I have to visit her. And every time I was visiting for many years, I'd always take a memento from Australia. Even this time, someone gave me a little stuffed furry kangaroo to give to my mother. Now, the first time I visited her, I had quite a big toy kangaroo, like a memento of her son in Australia. And she liked it so much, she put it on the mantel shelf of her house. Remember the mantel shelf, this little shelf we have over the fire? So she put this little stuffed kangaroo on the mantel shelf. She loved it very much. A couple of years later, I visited again, and this time I got a small koala bear. And she put that next to the kangaroo. So she had the pair, the kangaroo and the koala. The next time I came, I had a little kookaburra, and she put that next to it. The time afterwards, there was a platypus. She put that on. By this time, the mantel shelf was becoming very full. When the next visit, I had a wombat. If you know what a wombat is, it's an Australian-like pig. And she tried to put it on the mantel shelf, and all the other ones fell off. And so she was trying to precariously balance all these animals on this very limited space. And I told her, well, you've had those other things for a long time, throw them away. And she said, no, these are so nice, they mean so much to me. And I said, well, you can't get them all on. He said, yes, I will. And every time she put something on, some more things actually fell off. It's called mental breakdown. You get so much stuff in your head, you just can't keep it all in there. Now that is a stupid way of living a life. So I tried to tell her, all the old stuff, let it go. Everything. So you just have the new stuff, the new animal, in pride of place. That's why that's a very beautiful shelf. It's only got one thing on it. And if we get another Buddha statue, that one can go somewhere else and a new one can. But you don't have two in the same place. It gets cluttered. I don't know what your house is like. Can you get a vacuum cleaner around the front room, or do you have to move so much stuff? It's hard even for you to move around. Come on, be empty, be free. The less you have, the more freedom there feels. That's why this second way, or third way of letting go, is see how much things you can abandon and get rid of. If you want to know about the jhanas, it's like the simile of the hot air balloon. I don't know if any of you have ever been in a hot air balloon, but you may have seen them. They have a big basket and this big canvas or rubber balloon, which they put either hydrogen or helium or sometimes hot air, and you rise high into the sky. And you go so high, and you wonder, how can I go higher? And so you find these things called ballast, these sandbags. You throw the ballast out, and by letting go of all that weight, you go even higher. And then you look around, what else should I throw out to go even higher? And you look around, it's your sandwich, your little thermos. Okay, throw them out. And then you go as high as you possibly can. Or can you go higher? So you think, what else can I throw out? And then you realize, yes, the basket. So you throw off the basket, and there you are, hanging on to the balloon. And you go really, really high. How can I go higher? And you realize, throw yourself off. And then the balloon goes all the way to Nirvana. And in that simile, the ballast is all your attachments, which you have to throw out to go high. The past and the future, all your thoughts and everything else. And you go so high, and you can't go any higher. And then you think, I've got to get rid of the basket. In meditation, that's your body. I don't know about your body, but my body's a basket case. So you've got to throw that off. And so there you are, you, your mind, your identity, hanging on to the balloon. And the only way to go to Nirvana is you have to totally let go of your sense of self. And then you go way up, all the way to Nirvana, with nothing left, no weight. You've let go of everything. So in meditation, if you ever get stuck in meditation, what can I throw out? Past? Throw it out. Future? Throw it out. All the thinking. Are you one of these people who thinks a lot? Oh, come on. I will now teach you how good you are at not thinking. This is a meditation teacher's trick, an exercise. Because I remember once going to Singapore and teaching all these execs meditation, and they said, look, we can't stop thinking. I said, yes, you can. No, we can't. And I'll prove it to you. I asked them to please listen to me as I'm speaking, but don't just listen to my words. I want you also to be aware of the reaction inside your head as I'm speaking. Because as I'm speaking, you'll begin to notice that I'm speaking with some pauses between my words. In those spaces, what was going on in your mind? You weren't thinking, but you were perfectly aware. There it was again. Now you know what it feels like to be aware and silent. It's not that hard, is it? You know, because of that, and I've been trying to invent some more meditation techniques so that people can know how to be silent. And so over in Australia and in Singapore, I don't care what type of Buddhism you are. Mahayana, Vajrayana, Hinayana, Theravada, I don't care. It's all Buddhism as far as I'm concerned. So I use anything from anywhere. Look, sometimes people, I use things from other traditions so much that people often ask me, Ajahn Brahm, what are you? You know, not the normal Theravada monk. I said no, because in our modern world, the 21st century, we have to have synthesis. Let's all work together. So I said, let's actually get all the three jhanas into one. So I take the H from Hinayana. I take the aha from Mahayana and the jhana from Vajrayana, the three great traditions. What does that spell? The Hahayana. Yes, you've got it. You're another Hahayana. So I'm the Hahayana tradition. Hinayana, H from Hinayana, aha from Mahayana, jhana from Vajrayana. Anyhow, so I use the most famous mantra is the Om Mani Padme Hum. So now this is serious. If you want to learn how to be silent, especially when you're meditating, you can try this little technique. It's very successful. When you close your eyes, you can recite the mantra to yourself, Om Mani Padme Hum. But please put some spaces between the words. Om. Mani, Padme, Hum, Om. If you're thinking a lot, close those spaces down. Om, Mani, Padme, Hum. But as you get quiet, open out those spaces, make them longer. Om, Mani, Padme. Boom. So it becomes a little mantra you can work with. As you get more and more silent, extend the spaces until they get really, really long. And you learn how to be aware without even thinking anything at all. You get used to what it's like to have silent awareness. If you have lots of thoughts, again, close those spaces down. So as you're developing your mind, you can actually use that length of spaces between the words to train yourself to be someone who can be silently aware. You know, it's an incredibly enjoyable place to stay. And it shows you just how you can be fully aware without one thought going on in your mind. And that has huge benefits. You can go out into nature and enjoy the trees and the grass and the stars in this beautiful silence. There's that great story from Lao Tzu, which I often quote. He would go on a walk with his disciples every evening. One disciple, but they had a golden rule, you had to keep quiet. You couldn't say anything. And one day he went on a walk with a new young disciple. They came to a ridge on the mountains at sunset, and the poor young man, he forgot the golden rule of silence, and he's blurted out, "What a beautiful sunset." He'd broken the rule. And Lao Tzu turned round, went back to his monastery, and said that that young man was forbidden going on a walk with the master for the rest of his life. That was a bit too much, the other students thought, so they tried to intercede. And anyway, they said, "What's wrong with saying something during the walk?" And that was when Lao Tzu said, when the student said, "What a beautiful sunset," he wasn't watching the sunset anymore. He was only watching the words. That was such a profound statement, and when I first heard that, I understand why we're silent in meditation. You have a choice. You can watch the words, "What a beautiful sunset," or watch the sunset itself. And you find the most beautiful thing, the closest to truth, is a silent observation, not the observing the words. You know, much of your life you just watch the words. So when you learn how to be quiet, or money, you train yourself to watch the things themselves rather than their labels. So that becomes how to be silent, how to let go, throw away all of this thinking. Because you know the thinking is your knowledge. And never let your knowledge stand in the way of truth. If you understand what I mean, you understand that all the knowledge in the world actually hides you from the truth. You don't see what's there, you see what you've been told to think is there. What you've learnt, rather than what's actually there. Anyway, then you throw away all the thoughts. Throw all your wants, anything so we can throw away. In meditation, if ever you get blocked, you must be, "Oh well, I've been throwing away time." So, quickly, the other way of letting go is having what we call the Teflon mind. Nothing sticks to it. In the time of the Buddha, he called it the lotus leaf mind. Because you can urinate on a lotus leaf and it all flows off. It doesn't create a bad smell on the lotus leaf. Or you can pour Chanel No. 5 on the lotus leaf and that too just rolls off, leaving no residue. So we have to develop a mind which leaves no residue at all. So someone calls you a pig and it leaves no residue. That's why you have two ears for, one to go in and one to go out. Come on, use them. Why do people get angry? It is because they don't call you a pig once. Calling you a pig once is easy. What usually happens, after they called you a pig, you start thinking, "They call me a pig. Why do they call me a pig? They've got no right to call me a pig. I'm not a pig. It's not fair to call me a pig." And if you've been counting, you've just allowed them to call you a pig 5 more times. Every time you remember it, they're calling you a pig again. That's true, you know. That's why someone has abused you or hurt you. This is serious stuff. I give these talks to psychologists and psychology conferences. Because they've hurt you, every time you think about it, they're hurting you again. They're abusing you again. In life, if they're going to abuse you or hurt you, be cruel to you only once, please. Let it go immediately. Have the Teflon mind. the mind like the lotus leaf. And they praise you. Ajahn, the most wonderful talk. You're so a wonderful monk, a great monk. That's also, I use my two ears, one in and one out. Otherwise, I get big head. I've already got big tummy. Big head will be too much. So, that is the four ways of letting go. So please use those in your meditation, and you'll be so peaceful. Remember those four ways of letting go? What's the first? Now it's a test. I used to be a school teacher before. So what's the first way of letting go? Generosity, which is giving, expecting nothing back in return. Number two,
freedom,
which is happy to be here. Are you happy to be here right now? Then you're free. The third way of letting go, throwing away. You see how much you can get rid of. It's not to collect more things, otherwise you have so much stuff on your mantel shelf, like my poor mum, and she spent for ages trying to balance everything. Do you feel that life is just so many things to balance? Throw the lot away. If you want to go really high, see how much you can throw out your basket. And lastly, having a mind like the lotus leaf. Nothing sticks to it. Praise or blame, happiness or suffering, you experience it in the moment, then it's gone. Then you feel very peaceful. And then the meditation happens. And the more you let go, the more things disappear. You get, because that's what stillness is. As you get still, things vanish. Just like you, I was telling earlier, I once went to a meditation retreat at Throstlehold up in Northumberland. It was in 1972 or 3 or something. And we had to face the wall with our eyes open. Strange thing happened. After a while, I was looking at that wall, it vanished. That's really weird. But I realized afterwards, it's the nature of your brain. You will only notice things which change. Your brain is not wired to notice things which stay the same. The hum of the traffic in the background, you just don't notice it. The taste of the saliva in the mouth, you don't notice it. As long as it's constant, it's not noticed. So that's what happens while I was watching a wall. Nothing was moving, so the brain turned off. It wasn't important anymore. It vanished. That's why when you're still, things disappear. Because you're not moving, your body vanishes. Your eyes are closed, sight vanishes. There's no sounds happening, sounds vanish. Your whole five senses disappear. When they're left, go, what's left? That's your mind, the sixth sense. That usually appears as a beautiful light in the mind, the nimitta. Exactly the same light you see when you die. Near-death experiences, you die, five senses stop. You see this beautiful light. Exactly the same. That is your citta, the radiant mind in Buddhism. That's your sixth sense. Keep that still. And then you go into the jhana realms. The whole thing disappears. You're vanishing, little by little. That's a great advertisement for my latest book. Available for Wisdom Publications or by Amazon. The Art of Vanishing by Ajahn Brahm. You've got a copy there. Amazing. Would you please stand up, madam, to see? Is it available in the bookshop downstairs?
Yes.
Great. The Art of Vanishing. For more information, you will see it there. There's not many more copies left, I believe, because they have all vanished. Thank you for listening. Now can we have some questions and answers?
Yeah.
Okay. So, some Q&A. Who's going to ask the first question? Very good. Thank you.
When you were a young novice monk,
yeah,
what did you find hardest to let go of?
Oh, it's amazing that when you became a monk, you had to let go of sex. I had girlfriends. I was an ordinary, you know, young man, so I had to let go of girlfriends. And then as soon as you let go of girlfriends, you really got into food. And then I let go of food, and then you got into other things. It's really hard to let go, because as soon as I let go of one thing, I got attached to another one. You ever notice that in life? And that's when I realized that you have to be very careful, because as long as you've got a sense of self, you'll always be attached to something. I developed this simile of the hand, because I always noticed I was always picking up things. You know when you give a talk, you pick up something, and you pick up and fiddle with it. I said, come put it down, behave. And I realized that that's what a hand does, it picks up things. That's its function, its nature. And the only way to stop my hand picking up things is to cut off my hand. And then I won't pick things up anymore. The only way to stop yourself attaching to things and picking things up is to cut off the sense of self, the illusion of I. Otherwise, you won't be able to do that. You know, I thought I was so smart. I thought I invented that simile. Later on, after I told my friends, maybe a year or two afterwards, I found that in the Sanghita Nikaya, the Buddha's simile of the hand. That was freaky. I discovered a simile which the Buddha had already discovered. But anyway, that's why I had to give up. Food was the big one. Yeah.
I have to start by saying that I found you on YouTube a year and a half ago.
Really?
Watching you every Friday, well,
on the Friday night talks, yeah.
Absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
It's made a bit of a time. Sorry, I'm being big headed, but I have to just say thank you very much. And please, please, please continue to broadcast this YouTube, because there are people like me out there listening.
Yeah, no, I deserve that praise.
You deserve that praise. Oh yes, I know that one. You've done that lecture.
I've
seen so many.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Can I ask you a question, please?
No, pause a moment, but just for other people, why is it that no one receives praise? You say, that was a wonderful introduction. Thank you, Desmond. So, no, it's nothing. Because I see myself, people say, oh, you did such a kind thing. Oh, no, don't think nothing about it. But you criticise and, you know, you stupid monkey, so you told stupid jokes again. We heard that last time. I said, oh, yes. Why is it we receive criticism, we don't receive praise? And it's because we receive criticism so much, we make a mistake and someone tells us off, we remember that. That's why we get depressed. Why depression is such a big thing in our Western world, because we love to receive criticism. And when praise comes our way, oh no, it's nothing. No, no, I shouldn't do that. So next time someone says, thank you, you did such a nice thing, said, yes, I'm glad you noticed, I deserve that. Receive it, for goodness sake. And then you won't get depressed. You don't get big-headed, you get big-hearted. It's true, try it out. When people praise you, receive it, and you do it again. Reject it, and it's a wasted opportunity.
It's so true.
Sure, yes, wonderful question of yours. Well done. I
enjoy all your stories that you tell, and my favourite story is your two bricks story.
Oh, the two bricks, that's very famous.
Very,
yeah.
Very. But I just wanted to ask you, did you have a particular one favourite story of your own that's made a big difference to you in particular?
Well, there's many, maybe.
I know, there's many.
But perhaps the biggest one was that story of my father, the opening of the door of your heart. It's a great story. And for those of you who don't know that story, and it's very, very moving, and I do it for my meditation my whole life. That was when I was about 13 years of age, and in Acton, where I was brought up, it was a poor part of Acton, on Churchfield Road, I remember the street, just opposite, for those of you of my generation, used to have an ice cream shop called Tony Boss.
Yeah.
Some of the best ice cream, much better than Walls, they got taken over. It's Italian. No, just the home company's brilliant ice cream, love the stuff. He just parked his car, an old car, and he turned around to me, and I was a 13-year-old kid, and he said, son, wherever you go, whatever you do, however you turn out in this life, I want you to remember this thing. It's important. Remember this. The door of my house will always be open to you. It's a beautiful saying, but as a 13-year-old, I didn't understand what he meant. Except it was important. That's why I remembered it. And only later on, when I became a monk, I started thinking about that. His house was a council flat. In those days, you know, 50s, we were so poor, we would never lock the door. In fact, we'd often leave it open, hoping a burglar would come in, take pity on us and leave something. I realized it wasn't his house he meant, it was his heart. And as soon as I made that connection, just a whole world of beauty and freedom and forgiveness and Dharma and love and metta just opened up. Because what he was saying, son, wherever you go, whatever you do, however you turn out, remember the door of your father's heart will always be open to you, no matter what. that meant an incredible amount to me. I'm getting emotional now even as I tell that to you. Years ago, it was the first time I received unconditional love, specifically. And at that, I couldn't sort of just say, oh, I've got a blank check now to do whatever I want. I've got a father that always look after me. It inspired me. I just wanted to live up to that guy and do something which was really worthy of that. And I realised I've been doing that to other people all my life. So that I don't care what you do to me. You know, you can sort of criticise me, you can throw rocks at me. The door of my heart will always be open to you. No matter what you are, no matter who you are, no matter what you do, all of you in this room. It's a beautiful feeling that I can't get angry at you. No matter what you do. And for them that you'll actually live up to that and you'll just try harder to be good people. I mean, it's not just with people, it's with my mind states as well. I look at my mind and sometimes it's really stupid, sometimes it gets tired, sometimes it tells terrible jokes. For example, did you hear about this beautiful blonde who stole a policeman's heart? He booked her for cardiac arrest. It's a disgusting joke. Cardiac arrest, okay. Stole a policeman's heart. Okay, very good. It's not that funny, but I opened the door of my heart to my stupid jokes a long time ago. So what that actually means is you can accept yourself. You can accept life. I can accept all my stupidity. I can accept coming late today. You have to open the door of your heart. It's life. It's not intended. And the most important thing, which I found, that it's not just doing that to somebody else. Look, those of you in a marriage or a relationship sitting here, please tonight turn around to your partner. Maybe, you know, when you're going out or sometime, please tell them, look, partner, look, you know, I love you. I really care for you. Let's take it to the other next level. Whatever you do in your life, you know, you're my lover, my soulmate, my partner. The door of my heart will always be open to you, no matter what you do. Even if you cheat on me, I'll always love you. And I mean that. You just take it way up there. Then you find out they won't want to, they can't do that. Gee, if she said that to me, if he said that to me, I'm not going to waste this. I'm not going to destroy this. And then one day, say it to yourself. Look at yourself in the mirror. Or just in your meditation. Me. This person I can never get away from. No matter what I've ever done, said, behaved, wherever I may go, the door of my heart is open to me. Come in. Come in, me. Stupid as I've grown. All the terrible jokes, silly things I've done in my life. And I've done my fair share, as each one of you have. Come in and be whole, be at one with yourself. And all that guilt, pain of the past, fear of the future, just vanishes. Each one of you here has to do that one day. It's like becoming enlightened. Being at total peace with yourself, with all your stupidity, all your idiocy. Being at one with yourself. You don't have to be perfect to be enlightened. Just love yourself. Embrace, accept yourself. And you feel totally free. That was the most moving story. And I use that in so many different places. You know, make some mistake in your building. I'm opening the door of my heart to those mistakes. The aircraft gets late. You open the door of your heart to it. It's just life. It's not fighting it. And then you really are at peace. That's my favourite.
Thank you very much.
Have you got any other questions or have you got announcements already?
One more question.
Who's the lucky person having the last question? Going. Going. I'm afraid. No hands are up. So. Oh, he just got in there at the last. Yes, go on.
I'm probably bad because I was the first one, but I
thought. Yeah, no, go on.
Well, just take those two answers together. there seems to be a bit of tension because you lose your sense of self, but you've also got to accept yourself.
Ah.
Is that the great mystery?
Well, it's a sense of accepting just life. Accepting just the fact that yourself is totally indefinable, always changing. It could always be something different. So that's actually accepting just life, the fact that your sense of self changes. So you just combine everything. Just like this story of the seven blind men, not the elephant and the kangaroo. Seven blind men said there was such a thing as a kangaroo, but they'd never seen one before. And I just changed it, you know, the seven blind men and the elephant story, but I'll change it to a kangaroo just to make it fun. Or even better, the story of the seven blind elephants and the man. You know that story? I just finished off. You know the old Buddhist story, this is the adaptation of it. Once there were seven blind elephants. They'd always heard the word man, but of course they'd never seen one. So they decided the only way to find out what a man was to find one and investigate it, and then they'd all come back together and decide what a man was. And unlike the story of the seven blind men and the elephant, the seven blind elephants and the man, they all agreed that the man was flat. If you don't understand that Buddhist joke, you can come and ask me afterwards.
Thank you so much.
Okay, I enjoyed myself here. It's great to be here again.
Lovely to have you. Thank you so much for coming.
Very good.
And more of Ajahn Brahm tomorrow to remind you again. 6 to 7 p.m. at the Chaplaincy Prayer Room.
Oh. I didn't know that, no.
And then 7 to 8 in the main lecture theatre, the Sir Alexander Fleming building.
Wow.
So you've got two chances. You can go to the first bit or you can go to both bits. And the nearest underground station is Gloucester Road.
Have I got the choice which one to go to? Better off going to both, okay.
Well, thank you very, very much indeed. Thank
very
you.
Good. Nice to see you again. So take care. Very good. So what do we do now?